It's fine. I talk a lot as well, so.
That is a kindred spirit moment. Hello and welcome to the EDH Retcast. My name is Joey Schultz and I am joined today by my fantastic co-hosts. First up, the titan of death's hunger, or possibly just regular hunger, we've got Matt Morgan.
So Joey, I heard that Apple's developing a new car, but the problem is they're having trouble installing the Windows.
Well done, Matt. I quite enjoy that one. Next up, the titan of nature's wrath, or possibly the titan of wrath of God, that's Dana Roach.
With episode 100 approaching, Joey, I just made my appointment to get my EDH Retcast tattoo to commemorate that moment. So very soon, the faces of you and Matt will be forever immortalized in my lower back.
Oh, that makes me distinctly uncomfortable, Dana. What a wonderful beginning. Anyway, this is the EDH Retcast. EDH Rec is a deck building website that collects data from deck lists all over the internet to provide helpful recommendations for new commander decks. And here on the cast, we like to give all that data a little more context. Ladies, gents, and beyond, we have the distinct honor and privilege of being joined today on the show by a wonderful guest, the one and only Kristen of Hipsters of the Coast.
Good evening, or depending where you're watching, good afternoon, maybe good night. I don't know. I'm kind of ripping off my friend's podcast intro there, so I'm going to stop before I get sued.
I think we have the full spread right now. I think it's evening where you're at, it's afternoon for me, and I think it's still morning for Joey.
Yeah, and I mean, the only thing distinguished about me is the fact that I'm British, and we can probably go many places with that joke. So. But it's a pleasure. It's a pleasure.
It is a pleasure for us, too. It's so exciting. So you are just recently promoted to the content manager of Hipsters of the Coast, which is really, really exciting. Please tell us all about what it is that you do over there at Hipsters.
Yeah, it's super exciting. It was really cool to get that opportunity. Hipsters is a great little site, and we've got a lot planned for the coming year. If you're not aware of it, hipstersofthecoast.com. is a Magic the Gathering site. We cover a lot of the usual sort of Magic content, so we have a lot of strategy, a lot of articles about deck building and that sort of thing. But we also like to think that we're kind of the more niche side of journalism when it comes to Magic. We've got a lot of editorial content, we've got a fantastic news content system. We like to cover, like, you know, the Magic zeitgeist and what's happening right now in Magic as much as we can. We've got a great little team. David, who heads up the news team, is like always got his finger on the button. Brendan, our editor's fantastic as well. And we've just got a bunch of great writers. I could be here all night reading them off. And to be honest, if I try, I'm going to miss someone out and just make them feel bad anyway. But you should check them all out. We have all sorts of content. We have Commander, Pioneer, Legacy, even a little bit of Canlander at the moment. So, yeah.
Nice. That's really awesome. And before we ask a couple more questions about your experiences managing all that content and all of the fun stuff that you do, the content that you make, and your experiences with the Commander format too, we just want to remind folks real quick that we are approaching our episode 100, which means we are having a really cool giveaway for episode 100. So all you have to do to be entered to this giveaway is to follow us and leave us a review. You'll get one entry each for following us on Facebook, on Twitter, and for subscribing on YouTube. So that is three entries just for clicking the follow or subscribe button on any of those social media channels. But you also can get two entries for leaving us a podcast review on your podcatcher of choice, such as iTunes. So you have a chance of getting five entries to the giveaway, and we will be picking three winners on our episode 100. Winners can get in touch with us to tell us two things. First, whether they would like an EDH Rec shirt or an EDH Reccast playmat, and second, which new commander they will be building, because we will be putting together a cool jumpstart package including some of the high synergy and top cards for that commander according to their EDH Rec page to help get your deck jump started. It's really exciting, so pay attention for episode 100 on the giveaway. Subscribe, leave us a review to be entered for it. And that actually makes me kind of want to know, Kristen, are there any new commanders that you are building at the moment?
Well, first of all, that's a really cool prize. What are you waiting for? Like, get out there and retweet and like and review. That's a great prize. That's awesome. New commanders that I'm building right now. I'm kind of going down the path that I did not want to tread down, which is building a Golos deck. I'm sure everyone's got a lot of opinions about that. I'm not building it because it's Golos. I decided that I wanted to build like a Flicker deck, a Blink deck. And after looking at most of the available commanders, I wasn't really torn, like, I wasn't really attracted to any of the Bant ones, you know, like Rune or Rubinia or whatever. And I kind of wanted to, like, use some of the really cool black cards as well. So I was like, well, what's the best commander? Oh, I guess I can just play five colors. That works.
Kristen, how long have you been writing for Hipsters, and what do you primarily write about on the site?
So it's kind of interesting, actually, because just this last week was my 1 year anniversary of writing Magic content. Nice. So that's kind of cool. It's gone by really quickly. I started out at another site called masterofmagics.com. That was a fun experience, got to meet some cool people and who helped me get off the ground. And I joined Hipsters back in the summer, in sort of end of June, beginning of July. So yeah, it's been a whirlwind year. The main gist of my content is that I love to write about the sort of, I try and capture the everyman of Commander, to use a gender term, but obviously gender neutral, but you know, the every person who, the regular Commander player that sits down at their LGS, they have probably have a regular player group, but sometimes they play outside of that. They like to play kind of focused and optimized decks, but nothing crazy good. They get bored quite easily by kind of winning too quick. So I try and capture the sort of average slice down the middle of Commander content and go for things that people will be interested in, invested in. And my other main goal with my series is to get everyone to play Scavenger Grounds.
Hey!
Absolutely. Hey. Good advice from across the pond.
I don't condone this. I'm not happy about this. I was not forewarned about this.
So it sounds like, no. Kristen, it sounds like you like to play good decks because you're playing Scavenger Grounds.
Right.
But another kind of leads into a question we'd like to ask all of our guests. What kind of decks do you play? Who's your favorite commander? I mean, you just built Golos. You're playing Gravehate, so you're on a good start in my book.
Golos is currently on the operating table. The pile of cards I've pulled out is huge. I need to go through it at some point, but I've just been too busy. The decks that I like to play, the main thing for me is that they all have a mechanically different identity, because I like to keep it fresh between all the decks that I play. I don't like to have too many things that do the same thing, unless that's Boros and hitting people in the face, at which point I do make a slight exception. So, like, you know, I've got an Elshir Divining Top combo deck. I've got an Atraxa Super Friends deck. I like a lot of tribal decks. So I've got some vampires and some knights and dragons. I really, really like to play my Chainer Reanimator deck at the moment. It's
yes.
It really leans into the haste mechanic and just trying to just slam creatures as soon as possible. It's super fun. Nothing too crazy in there. I think the most egregious card is probably Sepulchral Primordial, but it doesn't get much spicier than that, I guess.
That's such a spicy card, though. Like, people do not account for the Sepulchral Primordial. It's not just my graveyard that I'm taking from. It's your graveyards, too. See, this is why people shouldn't play Scavenger Grounds.
This is why I still play it in my graveyard decks, because sometimes you need to get rid of other people's, because they're better than yours.
Blasphemy. Oh, I thought we were having a kindred moment here, but I guess, oh, no, that hurts. That hurts a lot. But I like what you said there about Boros. Like, you do make an exception for versatility among all of the commander decks because Boros is so much fun for you. And in fact, your article series is called, if I recall correctly, it's called Legion's Landing, sort of as a nod to your love of Boros and stuff. And I want to convey that that's also my particular love of, you know, the graveyard too. I have many, probably five graveyard decks at this point, and they all use the graveyards in different ways, but like that versatility among my commander decks is sometimes something that I lack a bit, but I do know it's important for a lot of folks to have versatility among their commander decks. For example, Dana, I know that's a point that's really strong with you as well.
Yes, for sure. And it gets more and more tricky the more decks you make, because that's just kind of one thing you've checked off the list, and you go to build a new deck and you're like, well, it's kind of repeating the theme from this previous deck. So it gets challenging once you get up to, you know, 6, 8, 10 decks to not revisit something you've already done before.
Right. I recently cut down from, like, I think I had 13, and I'm back down to like 9 or 10. And the current sort of three-part series I'm writing is about conserving design space, and I'm really trying to be quite stingy with it so that I don't end up with decks that do too similar a thing. Because I kind of sat down and I was like, right, well, I really like Alila, I really like Kaikar, and I really like Elsha. If I'm not careful, they're all going to be the same bloody deck.
Sure. Matt, I feel like that's a journey that you literally just went on.
I did, actually, yeah. So I used to have a Kaikar deck. It was all about tokens. And then I swapped it over because everybody in my shop has a Kaikar deck. So I was like, I don't want to be doing this because we could literally have a fatal four-way wrestling match with just Kaikar decks at any given pod. So I switched Kaikar over to Alila, and I had to make sure I was sticking to a theme. So I made sure it was historic themed, which is I'm really excited for. I just haven't gotten to play it. But that will happen soon. But yeah, I get it. Functionally, everything kind of executes the same way. Joey has the same problem, though. He loves graveyard decks, but it's how many different ways can I abuse the graveyard? Because at least we liked the combat step. So finer things for finer people.
Well, okay, listen, though. There's only one combat step, but there are four graveyards. So, there's plenty of versatility there.
There's one graveyard. That's why it's called the graveyard.
There's my graveyard, and then I might take from your graveyard, and then I might take from all graveyards. That's versatile, right?
Well, deflecting palm on Kristen's combat step versus Dana's combat steps. There's four combat steps. We're getting too deep into this.
Okay, that's fair, actually. That's a good point. I've been called out. I feel
let's disentomb ourselves from the graveyard.
Right.
Ah, yes. Clever. So, Kristen, you also, as a Boros aficionado, I mean, I have to ask, isn't Boros bad? Isn't Boros, really terrible? It's, the worst color pair in Commander. Sarcasm, obviously, very heavily implied. No, there are definitely weaknesses to it, but I kind of want to ask, you love Boros so much, and there are certainly some, deficiencies compared to some other strategies. There are some limitations on the color pair, and I just am kind of curious, some of the cool and unique things that you're able to uncover playing Boros so much, and some of the things that make you love it as much as you do.
Sure. It does get a bad rap, doesn't it? I think that most of the bad rap comes from people that are way too spiky to have an opinion in the first place. I'm going to throw that one out there. Because they just care about winning, right? So they're obviously not going to play anything but Sultai. So for me, Boros, part of what attracts me to it is I just like some of the flavor. I think it gets a bad rep, at least in Ravnica, for the sort of stubbornness, shall we say, of the color pie and the flavor. But I do like the idea of, standing up for what's right and protecting people that are being bullied and that sort of stuff. That's kind of cool. And obviously angels and knights are cool as well. But I think above all else, to me, playing Boros at a table where you can actually, play the game, it reminds me a lot of Limited, in that you have limited resources. You only have so many things you can do. You don't have an insane amount of card advantage. And you really have to play the game on a lot of different axes to win. You have to look at the tempo, which is huge. You have to look at who to hit first, who to not hit, who to hit more and do a lot of hitting. That's mainly a lot of it. But also just, when to board wipe, when to not. I've built a lot of recursion into my decks because sometimes blowing up the world is the right option. But I just like the challenge of it. I always feel like I've accomplished something when I win with Boros.
Yeah, that makes sense. It's kind of the artisanal guild. It's the one when you want to kind of do things the old-fashioned way and make it a bit of a challenge. You're going to craft that deck by hand versus some of the other color combinations sometimes feel like it plays itself a little bit. It feels a little machine-stamped. Boros very much is a kind of homespun challenge. You have to really work at it to get it the same results you can get somewhere else much easier.
Right.
I love the way that you phrased that, Dana. It's artisanal. Now I'm just picturing Haktos and Firesong and Sunspeaker and Feather on a cheese board or something.
Yeah, right. Yeah. at your local farmer's market is where you would get your Boros deck.
Yeah, I've heard Tajik's been brewing a new special ale.
Right.
It's called Legion's Edge.
Wow.
Sorry, they don't get any better.
So, Kristen, from your Legion's Landing article series, are there any particular bits of advice or tips or tricks for Boros players that would be worth passing on here?
Yeah, so I think the biggest one for me is leaning into recursion as one of your main strategies, because you know, people don't think of Boros when they think of a graveyard deck. But there's a lot you can do with the graveyard in Boros. Obviously, you've got the mainstay Emyria the Sky Ruin that you can put in your mana base. But also, just like a lot of the high-end creatures will bring creatures back with them. And you've also got one of my new favorite cards this year, Savine's Reclamation. It's like a mini Sun Titan. You get a couple of opportunities with. Although like the kind of the age-old argument of, well, how do you sort of reconcile blowing everything up with actually needing a board? You just have to lean into the fact that if you can plan ahead, you know exactly when to fire off your recursion, you can come out ahead. And I think if you have access to the wheel effects for card draw, I know a lot of them are expensive, like Memory Jar and Wheel of Fortune. Those ones are like super good when you lean into this strategy. And you can also hit Magical Christmas Land if you do it on top of a Smothering Tithe and basically just win.
That is a nasty combination. I really love that.
Yeah. So one of the big narratives from last year, and I'm sure you saw it too, was how much green got last year. In 2019, it had Great Henge and all these outrageously powerful cards and effects. And then white, everybody kind of felt was kind of pushed to the wayside, didn't get as much help. But you wrote a really good article that I remember we were all sharing in our group chat here with some of the best white cards from last year. So what are some of those that stand out that you talked about in your article?
Oh, wow. Well, first of all, thanks, because I was quite proud of that article too. There was a couple of people from Wizards actually reached out and were like, oh, this is sweet. And I was like, yes.
Ooh.
I was talking to one of the designers Ari, who's now on the Council of Colors for White.
Yeah.
So,
yes.
Yeah, he was, he quite enjoyed that. So I was like, oh, there we go.
Nice.
Cool. Yeah. So, I mean, I've already mentioned Savine's Reclamation and Smothering Tithe, and I guess they're the obvious ones. Apart from that, I've really enjoyed Ajani, Strength of the Pride. I know not all decks can lean into lifelink as a thing that they can reliably do. But now that we've got Shadow Spear as well, which does grant lifelink, there's a couple of equipments that'll let you gain life, and there's some decent value creatures. If you can just get to that 15 life more than your starting life total, like, being able to exile all of their creatures and artifacts and keep yours is insane.
Oh, yeah. I've been playing that Ajani on Arena lately. I 1000% agree that card is so good.
Yeah.
Sorry, when you said Ajani, I started thinking of a different Ajani. I forgot about this Ajani from M20. That ultimate's, I mean, I say ultimate ability, it's a zero, but you do need to have 15.
Yeah, but you can play it down and just do it, right?
Like, oh my goodness, that is devastating.
Because you don't even have to play him out. You can keep him in your hand until you have the life, and then you just play it out, and people are like, they won't counter it, really, will they? Like, and they'll be like, oh, okay.
Yeah. That is a version of card advantage that goes very undervalued. Like, you know, card advantage is not just drawing cards. Getting rid of everybody else's everything, that is definitely a form of card advantage. I forgot about this card. You're making me want to build a white deck, Kristen.
You definitely should. It's a journey where you will discover yourself.
I think that's the highest praise Joey's ever given anyone, actually, yeah, is saying, you make me want to build a deck that, and it doesn't end in graveyard.
I mean, my white deck also does a lot of recursion, so I'm sure it'll be right up his street.
Yeah, exactly. Awesome. Were there any other cards from 2019 that really stuck out to you too?
White cards or cards in general?
Both and.
Okay, so it was nice to see them correct Beast Within with Generous Gift.
Yes.
That card's like so good. And Winds of Abandon obviously is a great addition to many decks. I actually think that over the past year or so, like, the format's kind of sped up a little bit and the power creep's starting to show around the edges, and I think having another single target removal spell in your deck is probably a good thing. And if you can combine it with a Wrath that might let you just Alpha Strike, like, that's a good thing.
Yeah, I really like that one. And frequently, well, I say frequently, I haven't seen Winds of Abandon played too much, but the 4-ish times that I've seen it, I have consistently seen people not have enough basics. Usually if they're in like a 3-color deck or something, they lost 5 creatures and only got 2 basic lands as a result. And they're like, oh, it's not as much upside. Like, it is still some upside to forgive the fact that they don't have a board anymore, but it's much more devastating to have lost those five creatures, and the two lands don't help them catch up nearly as much as they lost. So that's also definitely a sleeper hit.
Yeah, like, I do think that unless you're going to take at least one player out, you probably shouldn't fire it off. But yeah, I agree.
Yeah. Well, awesome. Yeah, those are really, really cool ones for sure. And we do have some other questions that we want to ask, but we also want to get to one of our favorite segments here, and that is challenging the stats. There's a lot of data on EDH Rec, but we don't always agree with it. Sometimes we think that cards are seeing too much play. Sometimes we think that cards are seeing too little play. So what we like to do is challenge those statistics. Matt, do you mind starting us off this week with your challenge the stats?
I sure can. So my card so far is number 32 overall in most used cards out of Theros Beyond Death, but this card has been destroying me on Arena lately, so I wanted to give it a shout out because it actually fixes a problem for one of the commanders that I think could use a little help. So Nightmare Shepherd is the card I'm talking about. It is 2BB for an enchantment creature, which is a demon. It's a 4/4 with flying, but the important part is that it reads, whenever another non-token creature you control dies, you may exile it, and if you do, create a token that's a copy of that creature, except it's a 1/1 and is also a nightmare in addition to its other types. Now, Joey, I know you want to keep cards in your graveyard, but what this does is if you're playing a deck like Korvold or Yarok, or what I like is Alenda the Dusk Rose, where you want to be abusing either Enter the Battlefield triggers, death triggers, or with Alenda, the nice part about it is when Alenda dies, it goes to the graveyard. It doesn't go to the command zone in order to get that death trigger. But what you can do with Nightmare Shepherd is let Alenda go to the graveyard, exile it, get another copy of Alenda, and then go to the command zone afterwards. It is a nifty little interaction. If you're playing cards like Fleshbag Marauder, you get that Enter the Battlefield ability, sacrifice Fleshbag Marauder to itself. Oh, just exile it, bring it back, and get another token. You get so much value out of this if you're playing any sort of Enter the Battlefield abilities, death triggers. It is such a nightmare to play against, let's just be real. I think it's much, much better than only 261 decks. I think it's not the 32nd best card from Theros Beyond Death by any means. It is such a value engine. I would really like to see people playing this in general, but Alenda the Duskrose decks especially will benefit from this, because that's one of the biggest downfalls of that commander, is because you have to have it die. This helps kind of get around that weakness.
That is some spicy tech.
Yeah, for sure.
I really like that. You don't have to keep her in the graveyard. You can exile, sort of like Gerard, the Weatherlight captain, ship captain. I can't quite remember the title, but he was in Commander 2019. He also has a death and then exile trigger so that you can get the death ability and then exile him to put him back into the command zone at that point. That is really, really cool. I've been considering this Nightmare Shepherd for my Sir Conrad deck because a creature would die, Sir Conrad would trigger, and then a creature would be exiled. I'd get another version of that creature. Sir Conrad would trigger again when the creature leaves my graveyard. You might be convincing me to push that card into the deck. Because those are some cool interactions that you just talked about. And I'm keen on that for sure. That's really cool.
It's so good. I ordered one. I'm contemplating ordering two and putting another one in my cart right now, because I want to put it in my Taze of Karloff deck, because I don't do a lot of reanimation.
Yeah, Taze with their dice triggers. But she
loves,
nice.
Yeah, she loves tokens. So why not just make more tokens?
Oh, that's cool. And the other cool thing, too, is like it is a copy. It's a 1/1 version of that card, but it is still a copy. So it would still have things like their mana cost. For example, if I were to use it on a Grey Merchant of Asphodel, it would still be a creature token that has that thing's mana cost. So that would count for devotion. Man, okay, Matt, I really like your pick this week. This is a good pick.
Well, it is a graveyard pick. It's on brand for Joey. But it's so good.
Nobody needs to run Soul Separator anymore.
No.
That's true. Exactly. All right, Dana, you're up next. What is your challenge? And is it as good as Matt's?
We'll see. My challenge is a card from M20. It's an enchantment for 1 green. And I think the problem for this enchantment is it's worded in a way that makes it too good. And I will tell you what it is. It's Season of Growth. And it says, whenever a creature enters battlefield under your control, you scry 1. But the most important part of this is, whenever you cast a spell that targets a creature you control, draw a card. I think by wording it so it works with any spell, people tend to think spell, and I think mentally a lot of times assume instant or sorcery. So they go, oh, well, I don't cast that many things that target my own stuff. It's not that useful. That counts auras. I think if this was actually phrased so it said whenever you cast an aura The target's a creature you control, you draw a card. It would be in way more Enchantress decks. It's only in about 1,200 decks on EDH Rec right now, versus Enchantress's Presence, which is in like 5,000, or Verdurin Enchantress in like 4,000, Mace Enchantress in 7,000. It's, you know, three quarters of an Enchantress. You're going to be casting majority aura spells in most of those decks most of the time, or in a enchantment-based Voltron deck. It winds up being almost one more Enchantress's Presence, one more way to draw a bunch of cards off what you're already doing anyway. And I think people miss out on how effective it is in those decks because of the fact that it's actually better than it would be if it just said auras, because it's also going to draw you a card off Soul's Majesty or Berserk or something. So because it's good, maybe better than it would be if it said auras, I think people kind of mentally miss the fact that it's basically, like I said, three quarters of an Enchantress in that deck.
That's a really cool pick. And the aura restriction isn't even that much of a restriction for some of the different Enchantress commanders out there. Right. For example, Syona, Captain of Pylaeus, she's actually the most built commander on EDH Rec from Theros Beyond Death at the current moment, with nearly 200 decks. I think she's like just shy of 199 decks to her name right now. Season of Growth is only showing up in 62% of those. But that's just with her particular brand of enchantments, which are all going to be auras that target the creature. Season of Growth is totally serving duty as a regular Enchantress effect in there. So yeah, totally a great pick for that. I really enjoy that too. Man, we got good picks this week. This is cool.
I think in a lot of ways as well, it's one of those enchantments that hits the table quite early. And it's not quite offensive enough to get rid of, because it's just kind of not quite on the level of some of the other card advantage that will come down on turn 3 and 4.
Yeah, it's either going to get removed, which is kind of a win. Like, if someone wants to roll a removal spell on that, then I guarantee you have something probably worse in your hand. And if they don't remove it, then it's going to sit there and generate value anyway. So it's kind of in that perfect sweet spot.
Mm, yeah, I really like it.
That's cool. That's a really cool one. All right, we are going to move on to my challenge now. And this one, you know what? I actually had a different one planned, but Kristen, since you talked about Scavenger Grounds, I figured that I'll talk about this one sort of as a nod to your love of this card that wrecks my day in every possible way. Because there's a really important wording about Scavenger Grounds that sometimes I forget. I won't even say that other folks forget. I forget about this. Scavenger Grounds, of course, you can pay 2, sacrifice a desert, and then exile all cards from all graveyards, which is devastating to people like me who play Marin and Mimiplasm and Sir Conrad, and it's very, very, very sad.
So Conrad doesn't care, though, right?
I mean, I do usually want to keep those creatures in my graveyard.
Yeah, but you can kill everyone by exiling them, too.
I can. The Bajuka Bog for lethal on my own graveyard is a thing that I have done.
Yeah.
So Scavenger Grounds doesn't just say sacrifice itself to exile a graveyard, like most of the utility lands that we're probably familiar with. Scavenger Grounds says sacrifice a desert. And so my pick this week is actually going to be a challenge. If you are playing Scavenger Grounds, consider also including another desert, like, for example, Desert of the Indomitable or Desert of the Fervent, because those are lands that can cycle themselves if you don't need them. They enter tapped, they tap for just one color of mana, which is usually a big ask, but they are also deserts. And so a friend of mine was able to get me because I saw his Scavenger Grounds and I was so terrified of it the entire game because my precious, precious graveyard. And I finally pulled a move that I thought would be really cool and tricksy to force him to exile the graveyard and then be able to refill it later. And I didn't realize that he had not just the Scavenger Grounds in play, but also a Desert of the Indomitable in play. So what he had actually done is sacrifice the Desert of the Indomitable. And it was like, oh no, the Scavenger Grounds is still there. This will be terrible. I'm just completely shut out of this game.
Yes.
Just because he had one other desert in his deck. So the specific statistics on this particular one, Scavenger Grounds, is seeing play in a ton of decks, and people should play it, even though it's heart-wrenching for me to say that. I know, it's terrible. But it's only paired with cards like Desert of the Indomitable about 16% of the time in eligible decks, and that just seems a little bit low. If you want to have some extra added utility to your utility lands, this is a really cool trick that you can do to not just keep the graveyards in check once, but twice at very little cost, especially if you're in monocolor decks that would like to play these deserts anyway. It's devastating for people like me if you decide to try it. So Kristen, since you like Scavenger Ground so much, this might be another thing that you can tell people to run as well.
Oh,
just
hell,
one other desert can make a difference.
Like,
and there's 19 other deserts too that you can, you know, pick and choose which ones work best in your particular deck.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. I would always advocate for taking the cycling ones over like the first cycling card in your mana base at that point. But yeah, as was mentioned, you've got stuff like Endless Sands, which is really cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a lot of really annoying utility deserts, and it's really sad. I don't like giving people the ammunition that it takes to get me completely out of the game, but I am a slave to the statistics, I'm a slave to the data, and I'm a slave to good gameplay. And maybe your article series is just so compelling, and your message is working, Kristen. It's you're having a good effect on the world. Anyway, that's enough about my pick. Kristen, would you like to share with us a challenge, the stats at this time?
Yeah, sure, why not? I guess the one for me lately that it kind of got on my radar a little bit, because I was building my Neheb the Eternal deck recently, and I was like, right, I need some ways to give haste. And I was like, oh, isn't there a great way to give haste in Throne of Eldraine? Crashing Drawbridge. it's 2 mana, it's a 0/4 wall, it's an artifact. You can tap it to give all creatures haste. And the reason I picked it out for Neheb was that I can tap it for the ability and then weld it away with a Goblin Welder or an Engineer and get something else out of the bin, which is fantastic. But over and above that, it comes down early on the curve. You can play it when you're just setting up, and it gives your whole team haste, which is just fantastic. And a lot of colors that don't have access to that naturally can get it in a colorless form. And the reason it came onto my radar was because, despite the fact that me and my flatmate both opened a box of Throne of Eldraine, we could only muster one copy between us, which is silly. Like, I was actually mad. I was like, why is there not more copies?
That's a really cool one. I love putting a pair of boots onto a drawbridge to give the entire team haste. The flavor on that seems a little strange, but that is a really cool way with just one simple creature to give an entire army that you just generated the ability to attack out of nowhere and completely surprise people. This is one that I'm also heavily considering for my Titania deck, because the ability to make a bunch of elementals and then give them haste is really important in that deck. That's why I already run stuff like Concordant Crossroads. Having another ability to access haste could be really make or break for a deck like that.
Yeah, it's the same for Siona, Captain of the Pileus. You definitely need it in that deck if you're running that combo. And it's only run in like just over 1,300 decks right now, which is like nothing.
Wow. Yeah, awesome. I love that. These are good challenges. I'm proud of us. These are cool.
Well, Kristen, so you mentioned your pick of the or challenge stats is from Throne of Eldraine. What about Theros? Have you had a chance to get any Theros cards yet from Theros Beyond Death? What has stuck out to you as something that seems extra powerful? Let's tell us about it.
Okay, so at risk of causing an aneurysm, I'm going to talk about another graveyard hate card. Or maybe two. Let's do two.
I was hoping that we were done with it. I was hoping that I would sort of inoculate the conversation from graveyard hate if I mentioned one. Oh, man.
No.
All right, proceed, I guess.
Okay, so the first one is Soul Guide Lantern. I actually like this one a lot in decks that want to use their own graveyard. It's 1 mana. And when it comes into play, it exiles a target card from a graveyard. So it already does something when you cast it. And then you can either... I think pay 1 and tap it to draw a card and sacrifice it? Or you can just tap and sack it to exile all cards from each opponent's graveyard. So you get to keep yours, which is actually really good.
Yeah, it's really good. It's real good.
To me, like, that kind of beats out Relic of Progenitus in a lot of decks now. And I think the fact that it's so much cheaper means that it will for a lot of people too.
Yeah, I think when I first saw this, my thought initially was it's maybe not better than Relic necessarily, but like in some decks it would be. And then the more and more I looked at what decks I wanted to run it in where I had Relic, the more I kind of realized I just wanted this over Relic pretty much anywhere I wanted this effect.
Yeah, it's just incredibly efficient.
Yeah, and that's one of the reasons that folks are playing the Ashiok, I think, Dream Render, because it can actually mill yourself, prevent other people from searching the libraries, and also exile everyone else's graveyard, but not your own. And those are really, really nasty one-sided effects.
I thought they were just running it because they hated fun.
Yeah. Oh, well, that too. See, exiling graveyards is not fun. We should move away, but you actually mentioned that you had one more grave hate card that you wanted to talk about too.
I do, but then I'll end it on a high note after that, and we'll talk about some cards that are good with graveyards. So the other one that interests me a lot is Erebos's Intervention. I think for a lot of players, the main reason they don't run enough graveyard hate is because they can't justify it. They can't find the card slots. And it's something that I don't necessarily agree with, but is a fair argument in the sense that a lot of people have it, so a lot of people must feel the same. One of the reasons I recommend Scavenger Ground so much is because that flies in the face of that. But on top of that, now we've got Erebos's Intervention, which can be a removal spell, and it can hit graveyards. It's great. It does both. And it's a great way to get around Indestructible as well, because it's a minus X spell, which there is a lot of running around at the moment.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. Yeah, those modal spells especially can really be nice to make room for cards. That way it doesn't feel like you have to detract too far from your own personal strategy to make sure that you have good interaction with other people's. So modal spells can be a great way to make sure that you justify including those cards. And even just playing one, even though like playing this card that doesn't feel like it progresses my own strategy and it just gets, you know, slows down some other people's. Even just playing one of those can make you realize how powerful and devastating they actually are to other folks, which allows you to progress your own strategy. So some of those modal effects are even more powerful just to sort of open that door in the first place.
Yeah, if you can put tempo and proactiveness on one card, you're onto a winner.
Awesome. Okay, but you said on a high note, is this next one not a grave hate card? Fingers crossed.
Yeah, it's actually it's an enabler. I mentioned to you that I've got a Chainer deck, and the most obvious card for Chainer from Theros is Gravebreaker Lamia. This one's great. It's Entomb on a body, and it makes spells that you cast from the bin cheaper. So good. I just love the idea of getting back a Direfleet Daredevil for one red mana and just casting something from someone else's graveyard. Like, what more could you want? It's great. Yeah, that one, that, and Minions Return as well, I think is really cool. The sort of flash enchantment, two and a black. You enchant a creature, and when it dies this turn, Yeah, you get to return it to the battlefield under your control.
Yeah, that's really, being able to do that as a combat trick is so, so useful too.
Right. So yeah, like, as much as I'm a Boros mage, there's a lot of good black cards in Theros Beyond Death.
Yeah. Awesome. See, yes, this is the correct way, Kristen. Love it. There's another super interesting article of yours that we wanted to talk about too, which was titled Building a Casual Commander Deck Can Be a Challenge. And this was a really interesting concept. Do you mind walking us through the ideas that you meant by that idea that building a casual deck can be more challenging than building a tuned one?
Yeah, sure. So I think the main factor that is at play here is that the longer you've been playing Magic, the harder it is to build a casual deck. Not only because you have access to so many good cards and so many good synergies, but also because with that experience comes the ability to really squeeze out the last drips of value out of a slightly less optimized deck. Because whether you've played a lot of Limited or if you've just played a lot of Commander, you can do a lot with very few resources. And so just one, like, slightly on the borderline powerful card in a casual deck can be really used to great effect by someone who is good at the game. And that's to me, that's like the main headline. But then the other headline, I guess, is just the decision paralysis, because once you go under that first tier of like the best cards, it's like the tiers below that are like so wide, and you have so many options. And unless you have a really strict theme, like I'm doing, like Homorid Tribal, you don't have like, you don't really have anything to like rein you in. There's just so many options, and you can just sit there for days, like just in paralysis, like not knowing what to do.
Yeah, that makes sense. I have that paralysis looking for, you know, trying to tune things as much as possible. So the instinct, I think, in those moments is that I want to try and remove some of the like super optimization to try and relax that experience. So like, I don't have to find every single thing of value. So maybe I can just play some of the more fun or pet cards or something like that. But that can also make things potentially more challenging because, like you mentioned, it is such a wide swath of cards within that category too. So that actually, it does make sense that it can sometimes be more challenging to spin backwards a little bit.
Yeah, because I mean, the example I used in the article was board wipes. Yes, there are optimal board wipes, but really the amount of board wipes that we have access to in EDH that are efficient is is very, very high, because whether it's 4, 5, or 6 mana, there's like dozens upon dozens of options. And once you chip away from that top tier, like, there's not that much to distinguish them.
Yeah, the decision paralysis thing, I think, is absolutely a really, really good point to make about building those down decks, because the really great cards kind of eliminate so much stuff, which is, you know, kind of what you're saying. If you're building a white deck and you just have Swords to Plowshares and just have Path to Exile lying around, well, you're going to put those in your deck and not even really think about, like, the stuff levels below that. But once you get to those levels, making that decision and figuring out what you want to run there gets way more complicated. And that is absolutely a really challenging thing, I think, that I've experienced for sure when I've tried to, like, power down decks. Absolutely.
Yeah, and as you say, building white is just a challenge.
right, that's in general, right, yeah.
So, like, even if you're building a casual white deck, I would still say you should run the swords in the path, because...
Sure, right. your power is capped anyway.
Yeah, right, so...
Artisanal cheese board, exactly, coming back exactly. to mind.
So, yeah, it's a challenging process. I think the other factor can be that sometimes in your play group, you want to tone down your decks a little. But then, say you do it so that you can play better with a couple of friends, and then there's different people in the shop, and your deck's not suddenly very good anymore. It's like, what do you do then? I mean, not everyone has access to, like, a 6 or 8 decks they can just bring with them at a range of power levels. Like, how do you approach that situation? So one of the things I like to do is just have, like, not a sideboard per se, but, like, a selection of cards that can go in or out to sort of instantly change a power level, because there's a couple of axes that can do that, like removal, recursion, and just, like, top end value creatures. You can really sort of adjust a power level quite quickly by looking at those types of cards.
Very nice. I like that.
Yeah, I mean, like, just pulling out a Cyclonic Rift can make a huge difference in both how the deck plays and how it feels to the other person when they don't have to see that or worry about it in your deck.
Yeah, yeah. Let's just, for example, with the Rule Zero discussion, what is one of the things that gets brought up? Where it's like, oh, I'm playing Irelia, but there's no Helm of the Host in there. And it's like, oh, I'm playing Wildrotha, sure, but there's no this in there. I'm like... I'm playing Aloro, but there's no Decree of Silence and Solemnity combo. Like, you have that discussion about the power level at the beginning, and you often cite these cards that do have that big of an impact that just taking them out can just change the deck.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's never just removing one card. It's removing one card and then also, like, the strings attached to so many of the other cards. It has big ramifications. There are ripple effects of the entire deck just attached to one card. So that totally makes sense.
Mm. Yeah, I've had that conversation about my Muldrotha deck too, where I pull it out and put Muldrotha down, and I get some side eyes, rightfully so, but then I tell them, don't worry, this is a theme deck. It's +1/+1 counters. Like, it's not that Muldrotha deck. And then I have to make sure that my first few cards show people, oh my gosh, you're playing Implement of Ferocity. That's okay. That makes sense. Yeah. So people know I'm not trying to, you know, spike the table. It's okay. Strict theme here. We're good.
Yeah.
Well, I found that when you pull out a few of those super bomby staples, sometimes that's a good way to put in, like, a pet card in your deck, since those tend to be a little bit less powerful as well. Do you have any personal pet cards, anybody that they would like to throw out there and share that they put in their decks?
Ooh, one that I always try and force myself to play is Mazurek. I've always tried to build a Mazurek deck, and it just never quite gets there, because the secret of Mazurek is that he's not really a sacrifice thing. He's the one that puts counters on all of his stuff whenever a permanent is sacrificed. But he's not really a sacrifice deck. He's more of a token deck, or if you're using persist stuff like Woodfall Primus, he's a combo deck.
Oh, wow.
And neither of those things are as interesting to me as, like, I just want to sacrifice my stuff, guys. So... that's a pet card that I can never quite justify, but that I always try to, for sure.
Yeah, that's a good one. I guess for me, there's, like, two main ones that stand out. First one is, I don't know if it's a pet card, but it doesn't see enough play, and I seem to be the only one that tends to play it. Volcanic Offering.
Ah.
That card has so much value attached to it. Like, if someone's the arch enemy, you can convince the table to hose that person by removing 4 of their permanents. If someone isn't the archenemy and you're a little bit behind, you can convince another person that's behind to bring the other 2 players down a peg. It just has so much utility. Yeah. I love it.
Volcanic Offering, 5-mana instant, destroys a non-basic land you don't control and a non-basic land of an opponent's control, of an opponent's choice that you also don't control, and it can deal 7 damage to a creature you don't control and 7 damage to a creature of an opponent's choice that you also don't control. There's no blowback risk on this one. That is such a cool political tool. I've been using that in my Grubhub deck as well. I really like that pick. That is a really fun inclusion.
It's fantastic, honestly. And the other one, which I guess does fall under the pet card category a little more, is that I definitely made sure to leave room in my Edgar Markov deck to run New Blood. New Blood is 2 and 2 black, and as an additional cost, you have to tap an untapped vampire you control. But you gain control of target creature, and you can replace all instances of one creature type in its text box with the word vampire. Which is hilarious when someone plays Atla Polani, because then you can just cascade vampires out of your deck because you can change egg to vampire.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Because you don't have to change the creature type in the text, in the type line. You can change it in the text instead.
Change the text of that creature by replacing... Whoa, that's really ridiculous. And actually, now that I'm recalling, because I've seen New Blood used on the first Sliver, which gives all Slivers Cascade.
Yeah.
And it was changed to Vampire.
So good.
Give all the Vampires Cascade, which also would trigger Edgar Markov. Yeah, that's a really fun one. If you've got a Vampire in the command zone doing, like, even if it's an incidental Vampire or something like that, that can be inclusion too.
And the thing is as well, it's like, it's definitely one of those cards that if you are trying to optimize an Edgar Markov build would probably fall by the wayside because it doesn't fit in with the main strategy of just beat people as soon as you're possibly able. And it's also 4 mana, it's a little bit more costly, it requires you to have a creature in play, but that is what a pet card is. It's for those slightly more casual games. I say, with an Edgar Markov deck. It's more of a mid-range build, honestly.
I had one the other day, and I think this was a card I mentioned on one of our very first shows as a pet card of mine, which is Overwhelming Intellect, and it's a 6-mana counter spell that only hits creature spells, but you draw cards equal to the CMC of the spell you hit, and especially in like a 75%-ish meta where you are going to see people using things like Elish Norn or Sun Titan or Avengers Endicar for kind of win conditions. And you can also usually see that coming. You can see when the person gets to that turn 7 or 8 and they're going to make a move and drop something huge. Holding 6 mana isn't a lot of fun, but you know, worst case you hit a 4-drop or a, you know, 5-drop or something that almost always pays for itself. But the other night I could see the person playing the Kozilek deck was going to cast Kozilek next turn, so I just held the 6 mana and drew 10 cards off countering their commander. Feels amazing when you do that, and it's not a card I would definitely run in every blue deck at every power level, but you know, as a pet card in the right situation, it's effective and always hilarious to everybody else
who didn't
cast the 10 drop as well, which is always a great thing about a pet card when other people can, you know, be delighted to buy it as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. At risk of endorsing a card, which I think is just way too obnoxiously good, that sounds like it would fit great into an Uro deck. Because you're going to have that much mana way quicker than everyone else.
Yep. So final question for you, Kristen. You wrote an article about how players should try building decks without using resources on the internet, without deck building sites and all that. Why do you hate us? Why do you hate EDHREC?
Oh, well,
I'm kidding, of course. I know you don't mean that you hate.
I mean, I need to come clean here. I mean, you have a writer on the staff that writes about Jeskai, which is like the worst color combination.
Angelo, you've been called out.
For bad.
It's cool because we rightfully give Angelo routine guff on this podcast. So you're fitting right in.
Right. Okay. I thought I had to, you know, try and blend in. I kid. Angela's great. I both love and hate EDHREC. It's forbidden knowledge. It's the apple from the tree. It's everything that is like, oh, it's just temptation, isn't it, right? Because, like, for me, like, one of the main draws to Commander is the self-expression, the creativity, and the journey that you go through with the deck building. And I know I'm not in, like, the absolute majority with that, but I think of the wider group of players that play Commander, I'm probably in one of the majorities. And I think that having that sort of magic to discover and do the, you know, be the cartographer and map things out and figure them out for yourself is like a really rewarding and fun part of deck building. And I think, as I mentioned, like in the article, like it helps you improve as a player if you can pull things out yourself, and it helps you know your collection a bit better, and it helps you find those pet cards. And then, you know, once you've got that pile of cards, you can then go to EDH Rec or any other site like this and see what you're missing. And then, you know, if it's got the same cards that you've pulled out, you get a lot of vindication that you know what you're doing.
Yeah, I use the website the same way, like you just said. I build my deck and then I kind of use the site to what did I forget? What is absolutely necessary? Oh yeah, I should probably put in some, you know, this mana rock that I forgot about. I can appreciate that a great deal.
Mm.
Yeah. Oops, did I forget about Sol Ring? That kind of thing.
Yeah. Sorry, you just reminded me of a funny story. I used to play the Pokemon trading card game, sort of, you know, semi-professionally. I was pretty good. But I was playtesting a deck at one point, and I had 4 copies of a card in my deck, and I had 4 copies of a card which searched out one of those cards. And I was testing it on the online client, and I was just like, God, I have got such bad luck. Every time I play this card, I've prized the cards in my prizes. This is such bad variance. And I must have played like 10 test games before I realized that I didn't put them in.
Having a nice reminder to make sure, that can definitely be helpful. And that is absolutely one of the ways that we advocate using EDH Rec too, is like doing that work. Because you're right that there is a different sensation about understanding the value of cards and the importance and the nuances of their synergy. Sort of a good analogy, I think, might be like a sideboard guide, for example. If folks are looking at 60-card formats and they're looking for a sideboard guide, they might not know precisely why the person who made that sideboard chose those specific cards and for which specific matchups they will be using those cards to put in from the sideboard in, you know, games 2 and 3. And that's, you know, a pretty important thing. If you've discovered on your own why to put those cards into the sideboard, there's a really important distinction between that versus just, I copied this person's sideboard. And there's a, you know, a risk of that potentially happening with EDH Rec if you look at the data prescriptively, like, oh, I should be playing these cards with this commander. But it really is the way that we use it, just the way that you mentioned, that we want to make sure that we are here to provide ourselves with reminders. Yeah. But doing that work on your own is a really important part of the process what it is that you're after.
And that's why you have Challenge the Stats, because, you know, like, not everything's listed on that page. But I think another thing that's super useful as well is that if you're setting out to build a particular style of deck, obviously you've got those great filters on there, so you can go, oh well, if I'm building a Leela as an Enchantress build, let's have a look. But then you also have the option to go in there and go, well, what's the artifact build running? Is there anything that I might be able to put in my Enchantress build that might not be on this page? And I think that's a really important part of the filter system that you've got that I really like. I think I want to sort of highlight there, because you can look at different builds of a commander that might be different to yours, or just slightly adjacent commanders that do a similar thing, and kind of go, well, actually, that one card might come across quite nicely.
Yeah, exactly. It's a really good experience. That's a really cool challenge as well that you put forward in that article. So we do totally appreciate that. There's a lot of different ways to brew decks, and using EDH Rec and all of those different ways and the different filters and stuff, and then sort of depriving yourself from the data so that you can test those cards on your own and find their nuances and synergies is also a really important thing to do too. So there are so many aspects to deck building that is just really fun to reveal those cool, awesome things. But please don't play Graveyard Hate against me. That's something that we should just, the data all go to zero on, and that people shouldn't play. None of that. There's been far too much of it on this episode.
I think I need to save up to fly over at this point just to make a point.
I look forward to it. I would love to meet up. We would all love to meet up with you at an upcoming Magic Fest, or hopefully at a Command Fest as well. It would be a real treat. Kristen, this has been really, really wonderful. We can't thank you enough for coming onto the show. This is really great. And please remind folks, where can they find you and your content as well?
Yeah, no worries. It's been great, great experience. Really good to chat to you guys and get to know you guys a little bit better. And yeah, I'm pretty sure Travis sent me a picture once of playing an LGS against some EDH rec playmats with his hipsters playmats. So I think that rival's already there. But yeah, so my content you can find on hipstersofthecoast.com. If you just look for my author page, I'm Kristen. Got a lot of other great writers there that you should check out depending on what you like. And you can find me on Twitter if you look for @thekristenemily. Yeah, I'm quite happy to talk EDH if you want. I post some pretty good memes, I have to say. So that's, if you like memes, you might just like my Twitter page too.
Awesome. And how about the rest of us? Thank you guys so much for joining me. If our listeners would like to get in touch with us, where can they find you all? Matt?
You can find me on the Twitters and also the Twitch at Mathemus55. That's M-A-T-H-I-M-U-S 5-5.
And Dana?
You can find me on the Twitterbirds at Dana Roach, and you can hear me on my other podcast, CMDR Central.
And I'm Joey Schultz. You can find me at Joseph M. Schultz on Twitter. You can find the cast at EDH Reccast on Facebook and Twitter. And if you have a question, a keen insight to EDH Rec's data, or maybe a challenge the stats pick that you think that we should know about, you can contact us at edhreccast@gmail.com. Don't forget to follow the cast on Facebook, Twitter, subscribe on YouTube, and leave us a review to be entered into our episode 100 giveaway. And we will be back at you next week with more data and insights. But until then, remember, EDH Rec your deck before you wreck your deck. See, I like these magic reference jokes. This makes me happy.
We can opt out of them at any time.
No, I really enjoy it because what Matt and Dana tend to do is make references to shows that are older than me, and I'm like, ah.
So anything that was on the air around 2010.
Hey.
See, that wasn't even me making the old jokes this time, and like...
And it wasn't even a crazy joke. He was like 14 then.
In 2010, you were 14.
No. I'm currently 27.
I'm not, okay, so you are 17.
And a half.
I mean, to be fair, like I was like, what, in 2010? I was like, I want to say 19 or 20. Yeah, something like that.
Well, I mean, Dana was 70 in 2010.
Joey may have been 14, but Dana was first getting his AARP card, so.
Right. I'll laugh and pretend to know what you mean.
That was when I first got plantar fasciitis.